Static. Welcome back to Memory Static, the podcast that finds the stuff you watched when you were little, talks about them, and throws a party to watch them. And stay tuned to the end of the episode for a new original song written by me and my brother, inspired by the movie we'll be covering. I'm your host, Bailey Moore, and I have here for this episode's guest, longtime friend, Nolan Rosemond. Welcome, Nolan.
Hello, Bailey. Glad to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Nolan Rosemond. I went to college with the wonderful host Bailey here. And I'm a producer. I work in advertising now. I do like lots of like commercials and music videos and stuff like that, content stuff. I like to watch a lot of movies too. And I'm really excited to come on the podcast and talk about this one. I don't know if you've announced it yet, but I'll keep it to myself.
No, we haven't announced it yet. That privilege is yours. So what are we going to be watching?
We are going to be watching one of my favorite movies, Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon, a cinematic masterpiece, just a real good film. It was like a staple in my house. I think that was probably one of the most overused VHSs in my house, for sure. Like, and I know between me and my cousins, we probably only had like 5 tapes that we were just constantly wearing out.
For anybody that hasn't seen the movie before, can you give us a brief summary of The Last Dragon with no spoilers?
So basically, it's this awesome kung fu movie set in New York with the hero being a black martial artist. And it was probably one of the few ones that was like really, really funny during the time and stood out in my mind as like, I don't know, something completely original. It had really cool music. It had really cool haircuts. It had really cool clothing. Yeah, I don't know. I just remember every time we put this tape on, like, not just me and my cousins, but like my whole family would just kind of like sit down, no matter where it was in the film either, just like we would watch it.
Wait, so was that a summary of the movie?
No, that wasn't. No, it wasn't. Okay, let's start over about the summary of the movie. Okay, without giving any spoilers, right? Okay,
yes, so, without any spoilers.
Okay, all right. So it is a hero kung fu movie. I wouldn't say a parody, but like an homage to the Bruce Lee movies that like everybody loves, where a young Bruce Leroy comes on the scene and has to overcome the challenges of like all of these different neighborhood aggressions. There's a starlet in there. Her name is Vanity. I'm trying to summarize this movie. Okay, give me 2 seconds.
Okay, you're good.
Okay. Okay, so Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon is a take on all of the cool like Bruce Lee movies of the time. Bruce Leroy is a, you know, teenage kung fu master living in a tough urban environment. He's got, you know, bullies all over the place, but he works with his family and he meets a young starlet, a true video vixen, who's running her own like amazing, like, why is this so hard to summarize right now?
An MTV like programming with a dance floor.
With the dance floor, yeah. Her own American Bandstand Soul Train thing, which was really, really cool. And then there's this guy that comes there that wants to be famous or get his girlfriend to be famous. And he's like the evil villain and stuff. And Bruce Leroy comes on the scene and like opposes him and the neighborhood bully. Has all like the best elements of all those Bruce Lee kung fu movies. Yeah, you kind of like see his journey of growth to become The Last Dragon. There's so many good things about it. Wait, okay. How do I give a synopsis of this movie without spoiling it?
I think you've done a good job.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
How old were you when you first watched this movie?
Okay, I would probably say I was probably like 10 or 11 when I first saw it. I know it came out the year I was born.
Right. 1985.
What a time to be alive.
Just to date you.
Yeah.
Okay, so did you ever do any martial arts when you were little?
Yeah. I was a really, really cute and really, really pathetic taekwondo, like artist, I guess. I don't know, martial artist. It was one of those things that like, yeah, definitely was inspired probably by like the Ninja Turtles and like all the other stuff that was on TV at the time. I had a lot of fun in taekwondo, but like, I don't know, I was too distracted. Like it was like one of those other things that like, you know, you get put on top of your list of things to do after school. And I really, really wish I would have taken it more seriously. I think I only got to like my yellow belt. But I remember that like, wait a minute, when you go into the Taekwondo gym and you take your shoes off, we all started to smell a little bit like feet. And I remember that being like the number one reason why I wasn't into it. But I probably should have stuck with it. I look back and I'm like, you know, it was a selfish choice, Nolan. You know, sometimes stinky feet lead to great things, you know. So what are you going to do?
My sister's supposed to be here tonight, and she has a reason why she didn't stick with it for very long either. It had nothing to do with feet, though. But that's interesting. Did you like Bruce Lee movies when you were little?
Yeah, I loved Bruce Lee movies when I was little. I think everybody in my family liked Bruce Lee movies when we were little. I think we had one tape, again, like a single tape family when it comes to like VHS stuff. We had maybe about 5 to 10 ones that we watched over and over again. And I think like when I say single tape, I'm talking about like, okay, we have one that's just like action that everybody loved. And then like my grandpa would have his favorite Dolomite film, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think we had this compilation tape full of Bruce Lee clips and pieces of movies and stuff, but I don't think we had one like The Last Dragon or anything like that. But I remember like loving that tape and like loving all of those movies. And that's what kind of got it to me in the first place. Cause I definitely was one of those kids where the TV was the babysitter for, you know, I don't know, every now and then on the weekends and stuff when like the whole family would come over, pop in the tape and everybody would just zonk out.
What are some of your favorite memories surrounding The Last Dragon?
Oh, God, surrounding The Last Dragon, I would say our obsession with the movie itself. I remember one time there's a character in there called Shonuff. He's like the badass, you know, villain or whatever, the neighborhood bully, really, right? And everybody just shouts his name, Shonuff. This is supposed to like strike terrors in the hearts and minds of everybody around him and everybody in the neighborhood. And so one time my cousin and I were like hanging out. We were like, you know, what we should do is we should scare the crap out of my grandpa. My grandpa Arch was like a cool guy. He like loved Kung Fu movies too. We waited in a closet for this poor old man to like come up the stairs or return from work and like put his coat in and hat in like he usually did. And we jumped out of the closet after waiting there in the dark for like 2 hours. I have my cousin Amanda on my shoulders and I jump out and I'm like, show now. So we screamed in unison, scared the absolute shit out of this man. Maybe a little bit too much because he like tripped backwards and started rolling down the stairs. And my cousin Amanda like was like, ah, and like immediately like bolted to the bathroom, locked herself in, saved herself. I'll never forget that. My cousin Amanda's listening to this day. I'm still upset with you for that. So I defend for myself, run all around the house. Everybody was chasing me. It was so much fun.
Everybody was chasing you?
Everybody was chasing me because I almost fucking killed my grandpa.
Was he okay?
Yeah, he was fine, but like we scared the absolute shit out of him. And you know, this is a cautionary tale, you know, be careful, you know, don't jump out of closets. Oh, damn near have your grandpa break his neck.
So Leroy Green or Bruce Leroy, he goes out of his way to avoid violence. Were you a peacekeeper or a fighter when you were little?
I would say I was an instigator for sure. Like, I don't know if I was like a peacekeeper, but I remember being like, most of the fights that happened when I was a kid and like where I was living, like with all my cousins and stuff, we were just a big old pack of Rosemans and Goggins and everybody else from my family and stuff too. When they would get in fights with each other all the time, I was always like, well, you know, he said something that you're not going to like about your big ass head. And that would probably be enough of a seasoning to get those two to fight. I'm just over there in the corner with the popcorn, just watching it all. So definitely not a peacekeeper. I didn't really have to fight either. It was like, it was kind of fun. Dance, puppets, dance kind of thing.
Well, I think it's about time to move into the slow moving time machine. I kind of hear it warming up. And because like you're in Santa Fe and I'm actually visiting you in Santa Fe right now, I didn't actually have to use the multi-space function for the time machine. So we'll both be able to step into it at the same time. For those listening at home, this is where you pause to watch the movie and then join back in when you finish. Past this point, there will likely be spoilers, so consider yourself warned. The Last Dragon is available for free on Tubi or for rent on many different platforms. So, are you ready to step into the slow-moving time machine, Nolan?
Yes, I am. Let's go.
All right, here we go.
Chugga chugga choo choo. 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 Chugga chugga choo choo.
All right. Welcome, Nolan, to the slow-moving time machine.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Do you understand where you are right now?
Someplace ethereal. Someplace probably just between time and space and it all. You know, we're stuck in the time machine. We're here. We're going. What else? What am I missing?
Okay, so the slow-moving time machine basically splits our existence into two. So we are here in the time machine, but we are also watching the movie with everybody else.
Okay.
Okay, does that sort of make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So we are moving
slightly faster than real time, so that we will finish the interview here right as we are finishing the movie out there. And when you step out of the time machine, both memories are going to kind of intermingle, and you might experience some disorientation a little bit, but they haven't really ever been.
Long-term side effects, but...
You just keep me informed and let me know. There is water if you need it.
And some...
Dramamine.
That can be helpful.
Awesome. That'll go well with the acid I have in this cup of coffee over here, so sounds good.
Okay, so I just wanted to make a point to say that I've never traveled with the slow-moving time machine before, so like getting through TSA was interesting. I never really talked about this aspect of the slow-moving time machine before, but because the inside of it is not subject to the same physical rules that apply to outside of the time machine, so the... the atomic mass of it is actually negotiable. And so I was able to adjust its size to pack in my carry-on. And I wasn't sure if they were going to be able to notice it through the x-ray. But it seems as though the fluctuating atomic properties prevent it from being detectable. So no problems.
Wow. That sounds like a way smoother experience than the last Spirit flight I was on. That's you did good.
What happened on your Spirit flight?
Oh, my God. I mean, the last time I was on a Spirit flight, there was a guy who had his Pomeranian in a case and didn't actually check it as an ESA animal. I watched two grown men chase a Pomeranian down the aisleway, trip and fall. It was very, I don't know, it gave me like Home Alone vibes. It was awesome.
Wow. Yeah, nothing like that happened. And the time machine wasn't damaged by altitude, so...
That's good.
Yeah. Learning something new every day. Time machine ownership is a journey. Okay, so The Last Dragon. Are you ready to talk about how this movie was made?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I know a few things about characters in it and like the time, of course, that it was made. But I'm sure you've dug up a couple of goodies to talk about. So.
Okay, and you take over whenever you want.
Okay.
So one of the first things I encountered when researching this movie is how immensely popular it is as a cult film. But still, my initial research gave me a bunch of disjointed trivia, so I had to do a little bit more digging to find the story I was looking for. This is such a unique and interesting movie. I wanted to know where the inspiration for it came from, and I found a very helpful Uproxx article by Ashley Burns and Chloe Schildhaus that gave me just that. So thank you to them, and we will move on with the story. Okay, so the story of The Last Dragon and Bruce Leroy begins with the screenwriter Louis Gnosta, who also wrote Bird on a Wire.
I didn't know that. Awesome.
He decided to take his girlfriend to a screening of Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon. And the crowd of fans that congregated for the screening had a collective vibe very similar to what you would encounter at a Rocky Horror Picture Show event. So people were in costume, quoting the film really loudly, staging blocked fights in the aisles.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It sounds like it was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Gnosta was so taken with the energy of this fandom that he was instantly inspired to turn it into a stage musical. And his girlfriend, however, encouraged him to turn the experience into a screenplay for a film instead.
Good girlfriend. I like that.
Yeah, no.
Contributing.
So inspired. So does the scenario I just described sound familiar at all?
Yeah, I mean, it does sound familiar. I mean, I wish, you know, I had some girlfriends that were that inspirational for me. I think like, the, you know, like being able to go to those kinds of films and like, I guess, be a part of a community that like interacts in that kind of way is something that like I will probably never ever get back to, but I am very, very jealous of. That must have been fun. Like, that's an event. What do you need to go to the club for when you can go to the movies? What a time.
Well, it was so inspiring that something very similar is included in the movie.
Oh, yeah. I guess so. That's the inspiration
uh-huh.
for the beginning of that shown up scene. That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
So that scene is actually somewhat of a recreation of what he experienced at the movie theater in real life. It's even the same film that they're showing.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that explains a lot because that audience is like, yeah, that is just a crazy mixed bag. I think they've got every crayon in the box in there. You see a good mix of people, like, diversity-wise, and then you see, like, oddballs and like odd things in there. And I never knew it was, you know, inspired by that, but that makes a lot of sense. It's so cool.
Yeah. So Venosta wanted to create a young Black superhero character that kids would look up to. And so spent 6 weeks working on the original draft of the screenplay. When the completed draft was being shopped around for potential producers to pick it up, it caught the eye of another person that was interested in creating a Black protagonist hero that ran counter to the male protagonists in Black exploitation films of the 70s and 80s. Would you say that Bruce Leroy is a successful departure from some of those characters?
Absolutely, because like, I don't know, like once again, my grandpa, he was a big fan of like Shaft for sure. Definitely like Dolomite and stuff. And so you watch all of these movies and like, they were really, really cool. I love the music in them, but like they definitely all were like the same guy, right? A little bit like Shaft actually was a cop. So he was a little bit different and Dolomite was a little bit different. But I think most of the other ones like Superfly style were pimps or hustlers of some sort of nature or whatever kind of thing. And I think the cool thing about Bruce Leroy, he was like very zen in what he was doing, and he didn't have any of those other like distractions, money, drugs, and women, at least not at first, you know. And so he was like very zen and very, very cool. And like, I think that the other ones were a little bit more performative, especially right off the bat. A lot of Dolomite rhymed a lot. I never understood that. I really liked Bruce Leroy. I thought he like stood out. But yeah, absolutely different.
So let's get to the person I mentioned a minute ago that joined the project at this point. The man whose name is attached to the title, The Last Dragon. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about Mr. Barry Gordy.
That's right. And who is Barry Gordy?
Barry Gordy is the founder of Motown Records. He's the hitmaker, man. And I don't know if you know this, but I grew up in Detroit before I moved to Oklahoma, where like I finished like high school and stuff. But most of my family is from Detroit, all my cousins and stuff. And I think I was there until about 10 or 11 and then back and forth all the time. Still go back and forth to the good old 313. And I remember my mom just like telling me stories of like cool things about Hitsville, you know, the kind of like the Motown campus and stuff. And like walking to school and getting to see like, you know, whatever, the Jackson 5 on the front line and see people like practicing that were just like amazing and stuff. So like during this time, like Barry Gordy is like just running around Detroit, like he's a god. I don't know, like, yeah, Barry Gordy is like, I don't think there was like one person, you know, whether they were your grandparents, your mom and dad, or, you know, your age, that didn't know who Barry Gordy was.
One thing that he's known for is his impeccable eye for talent. Do you know some of the more famous talent that he signed to Motown Records?
I mean, yeah, I mean, everybody knows, like, I mean, the list is a mile long, but obviously everyone knows like the Supremes, everybody knows Stevie Wonder, everybody knows Jackson 5. Yeah, he was responsible for so many different people. I think also, didn't he do, the main squeezed is Vanity of the Vanity Six in The Last Dragon.
Yeah, she actually joined Motown after she started her musical career, but she had just started with Motown when this movie was made, or like shortly before, which I believe is why she's involved in this movie. Some of the other groups that he signed to Motown is The Miracles with Smokey Robinson, The Temptations, Marvin Gaye, Gladys Knight, and The Four Tops.
Yeah, all the greats.
Yeah, and so Barry Gordy received many prestigious recognitions for his contributions to American pop culture and shaping American music, including induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he received the National Medal of Arts Award from President Obama.
I did not know that. That's awesome. I didn't know you received that from Obama. That's pretty dope.
So by the time Barry Gordy picked up The Last Dragon, he had already produced a few films under Motown Productions, including a commercially successful Billie Holiday biopic called The Lady Sings the Blues, starring Diana Ross.
Awesome.
And because of Barry Gordy's involvement in The Last Dragon, we are going to need to spend some time talking about the music in this film.
Yeah.
But first, let's go back to the screenwriter. So Louis Venosta flew out to meet Barry Gordy and got to work revising the script with the director of the movie, Michael Schultz. It was Schultz's input that changed some of the aesthetic direction that Venosta attributes to the continuing cult status of The Last Dragon, like the costuming choices, for instance.
The costumes were so good in that movie. Oh my God. The gap between, you know, when this movie comes up, 1985, and then like moving into the 1990s or whatever, where I'm like 5 years old and like really like, I guess, developing my personality and stuff. I remember being just a little kid and watching that and being at 3, 4, and 5 and watching Last Dragon and being like, that is so cool. I know that that's cool. Like, I'm in PJs right now with a bunch of trains on them, and that's cool. Like, I want that.
So let's talk about the cast a little bit. And you said you know some of the stuff about the cast. So for the role of Leroy Green, or Bruce Leroy, it was a highly sought after role by many prominent actors that really, really, really wanted it. Do you have any guesses of who some of those people were that lobbied hard for this role?
If it was in Motown, I guess like it could be anybody, right? Like, I feel like they would have done something wacky, like even like ask Michael Jackson to do it.
Well, I could tell you it was not anybody in Motown. These are all actors.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, lay them on me. Who?
Okay, we have Wesley Snipes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome. I could see that.
Denzel Washington.
Ooh, I guess that kind of makes sense. Did they just ask actors that were like just actors or any martial artists at all?
No, these were people that wanted the role. They wanted the role and started lobbying really hard for it.
Oh my God, okay, cool.
And Lawrence Fishburne.
Oh, I could see that.
And the role nearly went to Billy Blanks, who created Tybo.
Now, see, that's the one that actually makes sense, because he like has a martial arts background,
right?
And like was already in like a bunch of like movies during that time where like he was like messing motherfuckers up.
Right. But that's not who was eventually cast. Right.
Who was eventually cast? Well, all I know now is that like I've seen him in that and he's iconic.
Yeah.
In this. And then I never saw him again, or like I don't recognize him in much.
Right. So the man that was cast, his name is Taimok, and he was 18 years old. And he's a kickboxing champion with no acting experience at all.
Oh.
But when he auditioned, he had the soft-spoken energy that the director, Michael Schultz, was looking for. And Taimok did his own stunt work in this movie. In fact, the scene at the beginning where he chops an arrow in half mid-flight is a real stunt.
What?
And it took 2 hours to capture.
Oh my God. Well, I didn't think that it was super fake, but I would have guessed that maybe there would have been like maybe a wire or something, or like someone just kind of threw it at him and he had to get it right in a couple of takes.
Yeah.
But I didn't know like that's wild.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it really is. I would have thought it would have been like, well, he would have been too old, I guess, but the black martial artist from Enter the Dragon is Jim Kelly. I would have thought it would have been like, you know, Kelly's son or something like that, because he's certified badass as well.
Now, Taimok's love interest, Laura Charles, is played by Vanity, or Denise Matthews, who I didn't know anything about beforehand, but really enjoyed reading about her. But I know that you know a lot about her, and so I wanted to know if you wanted to like tell us a little bit about Vanity.
Oh my God, Vanity is awesome. I mean, her life is amazing. Vanity is from The Vanity Six, and she is, you know, awesome, kind of like an amazing singer-songwriter prodigy in the 80s. And she was also Prince's protege. So like, you know, that look, that sound, the reason why everybody likes and probably knows her hit single, Nasty Girl, is probably all due to Prince. Yeah, she is, you know, look her up. Beautiful lady, a dead ringer for like Halle Berry. And I think that, yeah, at some point, someone should write a biopic about her, because she lived a very cinematic, climactic life.
Someone should write a biopic? Didn't you write?
Well, I wrote a treatment for one, because like her life has been crazy. Obviously, like I said, like she was shoved into this image of her being like a super duper sexy bad girl, which like, you know, from interviews that I've read, she definitely wasn't, but it fit the type at the time, and like, you know, it was working. And so she kind of took the ball and ran with it.
Yeah. A note on the image that she was projecting as Vanity. That was something that was created by Prince. Because the Vanity Six, it was all his brainchild. What's the word for that? It was his idea.
it was one of Prince's very many, very sexy visions.
Yes, yes. And when he met Vanity, he was like, "I, you should sing in this group." And it was originally called The Hookers. And they changed it to Vanity Six because he wanted to give her the stage name of Vagina.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm going to stick that in my treatment.
And she did not want that. And so they compromised on Vanity.
That is so, that's a, you know, it's a hot take. And but it also sounds like so on brand for Prince. So yeah, I don't know what it's like to be in that room and have to argue to not be, for your name to not be Vagina. I don't know what that's like. So it's a weird, wild world.
Yeah. Okay, so the rest of the cast, was also pretty young and fairly inexperienced, except for the two main villains, Shonuff, played by Julius Carey, and Eddie Arcadian, played by Christopher Murney. Apparently, the energy was really great on set. Everyone had a whole bunch of fun making each other laugh, and Murney had to sometimes be told to rein it in because he was just being so over the top with everything.
Yeah.
Faith Prince plays Angela, the would-be pop star, who is the girlfriend of Eddie Arcadian.
She's so great.
Oh, yeah, I love her. So the story behind that character is that Berry Gordy really liked the idea of making a pop star within a movie. And he actually invited Faith Prince to join Motown Records as their Cyndi Lauper.
Are you kidding me? Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
But
she was super flattered by the offer, but she ultimately turned it down because her true love was acting on screen. And she wanted to continue playing characters in the movies and not play characters in real life.
We have to respect that.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back to Berry Gordy. He directly supervised the music in the movie and in the soundtrack, which features songs from different Motown artists that were all new. They were all debuted in this soundtrack. The songs include new works by Vanity, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, and others. And what was the big hit in this movie?
I mean, without a doubt, I mean, definitely DeBarge. DeBarge and the Rhythm of the Night.
Yeah.
The Jerry Curls were just dripping. He was looking good. Everybody couldn't stop dancing. When I saw that when I was little, everybody was humming. Everybody knows that song, kind of like love it. In that genre, probably the two songs in my house that everybody like loves the most is like Lionel Richie's, like, you know, All mm-hmm. Night Long. And then DeBarge, Rhythm of the Night. Two bops.
This was like a huge hit for DeBarge. And the song got pretty high in the Billboard charts. It peaked at number 3
yeah.
on the Billboard's Hot 100. Which is like, you know, that's pretty good. So we're wrapping it up. But the film, as you probably know, was a box office smash. And it holds a major cult film status to this day. There have been a few attempts to remake the movie, which most people involved in the original believe that would be a mistake. Which, you know, it's kind of weird remaking iconic movies because there's something about them that make them special. And you can't really recreate that.
I don't want to get on my old man soapbox and be like, you know, get off my lawn with movies and stuff. But I think that like this film is kind of like amazing as is. Like, would you remake Big Trouble Little China? Like, I don't think you would. I think that you kind of just like let Kurt do his thing, have like this amazing, like, you know, moment in time. Like, I wouldn't touch it.
Yeah.
Let it exist.
So none of those have come to fruition, the motions to try to remake it. But the playwright, Louis Venosta, still has aspirations to see his original vision of the story as a stage musical. And he has been reaching out to contemporary songwriters that might want to take on the project.
Tell me, is Bruno Mars on the list? Because it's ready for him.
I'm pretty sure. I didn't write it down, but I think that might be one of the people he reached out to.
Called it.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. We'll fact
so
check
good.
That after this interview. So that's really all I have. Is there anything else you want to add before we join the party?
No, I would say, yeah. God, I just love this film. I'm really happy that you had me here on the podcast, but it was so hard for me to pick one. I love this movie so much, but I also like Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, and I hope that one day somebody picks that one too. Yeah. I would just say, you know, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
All right. Well, let's step out of the slow movie time machine and join everybody else. All right. We have exited the time machine, and we've also finished our screening of The Last Dragon. How are you feeling, Nolan? Are you experiencing any effects from the time machine?
Oh, God. I mean, it was a roller coaster ride. I had so much fun. Warms my heart. My heart gets the glow.
It's a really fun movie, and I'm really glad you picked this one because I had never seen it before. Is there anybody here that had seen it before?
Nate.
Many, 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 many times.
Many, many, many times. So everybody else, this was your first time?
First time.
First time.
First time.
let's just start with general impressions. What were your favorite parts?
My favorite part was when he was glowing yellow.
The glow.
That's one of my favorite parts too, because I love that effect of like the animation over film. It's so good.
I have to agree that my favorite part was when he started glowing red, the bad guy, because that was the first time we saw the effect. But that's when I typed in, oh, this is excellent. Yes. It just took it up the next notch.
Whenever I saw the red glow and the yellow glow, reminded me of my podcast, which was Mr. Boogity, when he totally glows green. And I'm all like, man, that is totally like an 80s special effect. They figured it out and they started using it like in as many movies as they could. And it worked. It shows like power and it shows strength. It really like makes it exciting. So it was really awesome to see that.
Nobody mentioned in Mr. Boogity that Mr. Boogity had the glow, just the evil glow.
Mr. Boogity had the glow.
Yeah. Mr. Boogity?
Yeah, you'll have to go back and listen to that podcast.
I've listened to it. She has not.
But Mr. Boogity is a children's show, so she can watch that one.
On Disney Plus.
And I think you're right. Like, I think like everybody really did start using that effect. Like, I mean, you guys all have probably seen Big Trouble in Little China, right? Like most of us, every single one of us probably. And like, you know how cool like those lasers and like all of those effects are. And I wonder if like they didn't like get inspired by Barry Gordy's Last Dragon. Like, I could see that happening for sure.
I really enjoyed how colorful of villains they had throughout the movie. There was like everything from like real Brooklyn thugs or like real New York 1980s thugs to like these like hybrid martial artists to kind of these like Neanderthal men that are like, you know, wearing pelts and stuff. And so it was like cross-cultural. It was cross like generational. You know, I feel like they took like so many different elements from like ancient civilizations and like modern civilizations and like this big hodgepodge of different styles to create these villains. And I mean, in a weird way it worked, but also in a weird way it made you like question like, what the hell am I watching?
Yeah, definitely. Well, definitely, like that was like the weirdest thing in the world. Like, he has like a career fair for like goons.
Yeah.
they all like show up and audition. Like, I thought that was like super duper weird. But you know, obviously at that point the rest of his crew had gotten beaten up already, you know, and he's got to replace these guys. I mean, sometimes you have to have a casting call, I guess. I like that moment. And then I liked Asian dudes that ran the fortune cookie company. They did that like almost like James Brown song, like lip sync song section, and like all choreographed, everybody's into it. I think the whole like point of that was to like kind of like turn things on its head. Like, as far as like, usually you see like, you know, the black dudes doing that in like a movie like that. And then like giving that like kind of like soul section to like the Asian dudes was just really, really cool. And just like super cute. I don't know. Makes you smile. It was nice.
And the whole thing during that scene is like, sorry, like you're not brother enough.
Yeah. Which was like great. Cause it's like him trying to talk jive when like everybody else in that film is like speaking jive stuff and like, get out of here, cool breeze. Like, I don't know what that means, but like, I just loved like hearing like all those kind of lines like come out of other people's mouths. Like, it was great.
I mean, the whole vibe of the movie is great. And I enjoy seeing it with people who've never seen it before, because there's that point where you realize that this is also a music film. If you didn't know that going in, that's generally when the Arcadian stuff comes in and suddenly you're watching a DeBarge music video. And you're like, oh, okay, this is a fun little diversion. But no, that is the beat of the whole movie settling in and getting you ready for the rest of the ride. That's one of my favorite moments in the film because of what it's like watching it with other people, watching it with an audience.
Yeah, like I said in our chat, oh, there's so much music. I didn't realize we were watching a musical.
Well, the song, The Glow, I was like, oh, this song's really cool.
It's a good song.
And so I like Shazammed it. Willie Hutch, like, who is Willie Hutch? and he wrote like a ton of music for Michael Jackson, the Jackson 5, Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye. And I'm like, that's badass. No wonder it's such a badass song. This whole soundtrack has been so groovy. You know, I don't listen to a lot of Motown, but maybe I should.
Did you guys catch that Stevie Wonder song that was in there? I've watched the film like a bunch of different times. And I don't know, it never really like was like super apparent to me that like there's a Stevie Wonder track in there. It's real, real good too. It's kind of a nice little surprise.
The whole movie was like, felt like one big action sequence. Well, like half of the movie felt like that. And the other half was this like pop star espionage thing. And I think my favorite parts of the movie were the like two or three scenes that they used to set up those plots coming together. Cause it was like two totally separate conflicts. And then two of the people in the, like the secondary people of those secondary conflicts bring both of them together for the main fight. I didn't really know how they were going to set up the main fight, but it's cool that they used the dance room.
Mm-hmm.
I know I said that my favorite part was the red glow before the yellow glow, but really I think that it's any time that Faith Prince was on screen.
Absolutely. Her costumes are the best.
I liked the little brother. He was the little hater. And he was like, if you got it, you wouldn't even know what to do with it.
I have to agree with Alice. I feel like the glow was definitely where it got very exciting.
Does anyone have any stories about learning martial arts when they were a child?
This one I have a story for, because I did learn martial arts as a child. And I got up to, I think, like blue belt, green stripe, which is the highest belt they let you get before you actually get good. But I was in this when I was like 7 or something like that. And I had learned how to crack my knuckles before anybody else had thought to do that. So I didn't have to be good, because the kids were kind of scared of me for just cracking my knuckles at them and threatening to crack their knuckles. Or like boys that were bigger than me that thought I was scary. That was fun. So I guess I relate a lot to the kid in the Kung Fu class that just intimidated his way out of fights until he actually got hit.
I have a story as well. Bailey, I don't know if you remember this or not, but I really, really wanted to take karate classes when I was a kid. And finally, our mother, our father, I'm not sure. I don't know which one was against it, but, or if they both were, but they eventually let me do it. And we went to the class and the teacher had all but 3 teeth missing. And I decided after looking at him that this was not the way. I decided never to go back.
Did you afraid you'd have, you, were you afraid that you'd have your teeth knocked out?
I think it was also that I'm not sure that I wanted someone missing all of their teeth to be the one to teach me.
I think it's a rule of 3. You lost 1 tooth, you got hit, and now you're better from it. But you lose 2 more teeth after that, maybe you aren't learning from your mistakes.
Exactly.
Right.
I would have stayed in karate if they had those cool leopard skin sashes.
Those are pretty cool.
I remember wanting to learn karate. I saw my parents signed me up for karate. And I remember like the very first steps of karate are learning what I think, this has been a long time, but I think it's called a kata or something. And it's like a 10 or 15 move sequence that you have to do that's not like interacting with anybody else. Like you're just in a line and you're just like doing these movements. And I was like, this is so boring. Like, when am I going to get to fight someone? And we spent like so long learning these just like moves in front of like a big mirror. And I was like, this is not for me. And I quit. It was, I just wanted to fight someone. But you have to learn these moves to get past that so you can fight someone.
It's a discipline.
I must not have had it at the time.
That's actually the same thing that stopped me from continuing in that class, because you had to memorize the sequence of moves before moving on to the next belt level.
Right.
And I couldn't memorize the one for the next belt level, so I just stopped.
I have a similar bouncing off of taking a class story that comes from after learning poorly taught Wing Chun moves from my dad, who learned from his dad, who emigrated from China to Cuba in the 20s. So the limited amount of martial arts and Chinese that I learned from my dad were flawed in both respects. But I found my familiarity with some of the basic tenets of Kung Fu really definitely clashed with the Taekwondo that they were teaching at the Y. And my parents signed me up because I wanted to take martial arts. And so I was learning from this guy who was called Coach Bill. And he talked like this, and you got to learn how to break these boards, son. This was maybe not the person to learn any kind of martial arts from. It wasn't so much the learning of form, which is, you know, it's called different things in different disciplines, but learning the stuff against a mirror, I was having no trouble with figuring that kind of stuff out. But it was like, no matter how quickly I was able to advance, I had to go at the pace of this pyramid scheme of belts and stripes and breaking boards. And so I got my yellow belt and I was done. And that was basically it. But like, I think many of us grew up in the Ninja Turtle generation. And mm-hmm. So martial arts was a thing that a lot of people were interested in. And it rarely came into play on the playground. But the one time that a kid didn't believe that I was Chinese, which I'm ethnically ambiguous to the point that nobody knows what I am. But by the time he accepted that I was, in fact, of Chinese descent, he then decided to tell all the racist jokes, and I thrust kicked him into the monkey bars, and he was more injured than they thought that an 8-year-old could do to somebody. So I was proud, and I also completely got away with it.
That's a good story.
Well, my whole family, like my dad and my siblings and my mom, we all took karate together. And our teacher was this woman who had, we were told, had come from this big family. And turns out, I didn't really understand at the time who she was, but she's Malcolm Forbes's daughter. So she was one of the Forbes kids who she turned into a big hippie and moved to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and taught karate. She's an amazingly wonderful woman who does a lot of charitable things as well. But
that's awesome.
Thank you.
Our story.
What were your favorite costumes in this movie? This has a lot of really great costumes. I see Alice has a favorite.
My favorite was when he had the black robe.
Which part was that?
I think it was the part where he busts in and puts the guy's head in the tank.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, that is a good costume.
That was the most ninja costume,
I believe. But there's also a ninja costume where he has the mask.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He gets his mask ripped off. Yeah, that's a good one.
It's hard because Shonuf has so many good costumes.
Mm-hmm.
But when he bust into the pizza parlor and he's got these red foam shoulder pads that are like protruding out of his body, and like he always seems that they took, you know, the old football pads, beefed them up and covered them with a ton of foam, and with his like rippling abs showing quite often. And I just think that look, like with that poofy hair, it looks like it belongs on a member of KISS.
Oh, if his hair was his natural hair or if it was a wig, but it was the best wig or the best hairdo.
The only time it got messed up was in the final fight scene.
Well, what about in the theater? Doesn't he get like kicked once from the side and then he kind of like, he's like, gross. Other than that, the rest of those looks are fire.
Yeah. Although I think that the winning costume has to go to, I don't know what her character name is.
The wannabe?
Angela or Angie or something?
It's something like that.
Yeah.
With the giant piece of, I called it plexiglass. I don't know what it was.
Yeah. It looked like like a sugar crystal.
Yeah.
See, it's hard to pick just favorites from just the ones that she wore, like in like all the music videos. And then like, obviously there's the one where she's just like, she's a car or she's a bicycle, like the one with all the reflections. I don't know, but like that one is like fire. I like that one a lot. There's so many Halloween costumes in this movie, it's ridiculous.
She's definitely a car.
She's a car? Okay.
Yeah, she's got a license plate.
Oh yeah, on her butt. On her butt.
Her outfits are so like, and like her character too, it's so 1980s Madonna. Mm-hmm. Because 1980s Madonna is like, excuse my language, but she was like the slut. And you know, she like totally ran with that. She wanted to push the boundaries of like risque, and she wanted to show skin, and she wanted to be so over the top and wearing these like big elaborate like headpieces or cones on her boobs.
I feel like she was like Madonna meets Cyndi Lauper.
Yep. She was definitely modeled after Cyndi Lauper.
Oh, okay.
Alice has something to say.
I think she was a car in the other.
Thank you for clearing that up. Thank you.
She was a car.
I was confused.
Here we go.
Yeah, we've got the definitive answer.
Whoever did the costume design in this movie definitely had a fun job.
You know, I didn't get the name, but I read somewhere that the person that was in charge of costuming did costuming for Broadway or stage musicals.
That tracks.
It sort of gave me Running Man vibes.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I was saying that the entire time because, like, you know, remember when you see Eddie Arcadia's face on that screen, you know, like, you know, and he's just like, and it's going in and out. But it's weird because I think he's like, or Bailey told me, like, it's weird because he's definitely holding the camera and he's like, you know, doing this with the camera and being maniacal at the same time. I don't know. It's a look.
For listeners at home, moving the camera further and closer to the face.
Yeah.
So the amazing thing is that I looked this up in advance because I knew we were going to talk about costuming. And I was like, there's something about this costume designer. Not only did Michael DeMora also do Grease 2, but in fact was the costume designer for Marathon Man.
Ah,
that's incredible.
Yeah. The Broadwayization of a bunch of the costume work. I mean, that's what this guy got hired for. But yeah, he was big on color and color popping. And yeah,
he was obviously really good at it. Does anyone have any stories about being a fighter or a peacekeeper when you were little?
I have a short story. When I was very small, I had two best friends. And this friendship came to a very abrupt end when these two friends got into a fight about who had the worst life. And I ended up the person going from one room to relay the message to the one sulking in a different room in my house. One was my room and one was my sister's room. And telling the other person the next part of the argument until it was time for them to go home. And I never invited them over again.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Drama.
Okay, I have a story I can share. This is like, you know, it was bad. Don't do this. Alice, close your ears. When I was little, I did not like it when I was excluded from things, when things were only boys allowed or whatever. And it would make me really mad. And Sean, you might remember this. This is actually at your house. Sean had a treehouse in his backyard. And you know, I was up in the treehouse with Sean and his friends, and one of your friends told me I couldn't be there. And I was like, yes, I can. And he was very adamant about me not being there, so I pushed him out of the treehouse.
You did? Ooh, I thought these were supposed to be stories of peacekeeping.
And just to paint the picture, this treehouse was in a magnolia tree next to my house, and it was like, it was not that one.
Don't make it worse.
It was like a good 10 to 12 feet off the ground with some very dangerous, devastating roots below it.
Oh my gosh.
Stop it. I'm giving you a slow clap right now, baby.
To all the listeners out there, that is why you do not exclude women. That is not, because women will fight back.
Yes, we will.
You will get pushed right out the tree. Maybe it's not a tree house, but maybe it's a real house or maybe it's a car. They will come back fighting.
Love it.
I have a question for you, Bailey. Did anyone ever try to kick you out of the treehouse again after that?
No.
I didn't think so.
Bailey was always invited in my treehouse.
Yeah.
Or else.
Or yes. You goddamn right.
Ricardo, I saw you took yourself off mute for a second. Did you have something to say?
I was getting Macaulay Culkin good son vibes.
Well, I don't know what that is.
Oh, I hope someone picks that one too. That's a real good, like 95, 96 movie, I think. Good son. He was Macaulay in his prime, and he definitely is not on his like Kevin, nice guy. We're rooting for you vibe. He's totally evil in that one, and it's great.
Oh, wait. So am I the evil one?
Yeah.
The good son is him and Elijah Wood, and do I have it right? Macaulay Culkin was like the cousin, and Elijah Wood was the nice boy who came to visit. And it's that Macaulay starts showing more and more signs of like full on sociopathic behavior.
And then, but it also, I think it's like it's sociopathic behavior, but then also like Elijah can't prove it. So Elijah looks a little bit crazy or like a liar at least.
Stop throwing yourself out of the tree. Elijah Bailey didn't push you.
Hey, listen.
It's just me, Bailey. All smiles, all dimples.
I know not to push people out of tree houses, okay? I was a child. I know how to use my words.
I'm sure everybody has feuds with their siblings. a couple of siblings are in this room right now. Me and my sister, we had our fair bit of feuds. She was like 3 years older than me. The way our family works is like we have like 13 cousins, Bailey and Chaney being my cousins. And we're all spaced.
And Lindsay.
Is Lindsay in here? Sorry, I didn't know if Lindsay's in here. Okay, sorry. And Lindsay, yes. Definitely. And we're all spaced about a year apart from each other. So Bailey's a year older than me. Chaney's a year younger than me. And so on. And my sister being 3 years older than me, like I got picked on a lot. And being a little brother, I did not like getting picked on, especially by older sister. So one time I was going to vacation Bible school. And I had this bag of pennies that I had collected to put into the offering when I got to vacation Bible school. And we were walking to my neighbor's house and my sister was picking on me and she was making fun of me in front of other people. And it's bad enough when you pick on me in the privacy of our own home. But if you do it in front of people, like that's like the worst for me. I don't like being put on the spot. So what do I do? And my little 10-year-old self was take that bag of pennies and smack the whole thing right over my sister's head with it. And the bag of pennies exploded everywhere.
It was meant for the church, but it ended up on Charlie's head.
It did not make it to the church. Of course, me being Mr. Sensitive, like bust my sister in the head with these pennies, and then I immediately start bawling my eyes out. Because anytime I've ever gotten in a fight, I always end up being the one that's crying. I don't know what happens inside of me. I'm just a big ball of emotion, and I can't help myself. So I run home, and I get in trouble for hitting my sister with the pennies. But I'm like, but she was making fun of me in front of people. And, you know, there's a lesson there, which is even if people, you know, take the high road, you know, turn the other cheek and walk away. But I didn't understand that at the time. At the time, it was like, do what you have to do to get her to stop. And so I didn't get to go to vacation Bible school. I probably still have not apologized to her for that. So, Charlie, if you ever listen to this, I apologize for hitting you with those pennies. And you owe the church a couple dollars.
Oh, I also apologize to the person I pushed out of a treehouse.
Yeah, the Moore family might need to have a...
Hey, we are fighting. We are fighters.
I didn't even take my turn yet.
Yes, Lindsay, your turn.
Just to clarify, the question is about being a peacemaker, right?
A fighter or a peacemaker.
Or a peacemaker. Okay, gotcha. People are just have more stories about one than the other.
Yeah.
I have both with the same person.
Okay.
My sister, because she was a lot like Charlie, like she would pick and pick and pick and pick. And, you know, Sean and I'm also very sensitive, but I didn't feel bad about this one. She was making fun of me because I couldn't go outside. I got in trouble. So I punched her in the nose. She had a nosebleed. Ah. I don't think she did that again for a long time. So I don't think I apologized either. Anyway, the other part of the story was there was a guy that picked on her. We were both in elementary school. I was in kindergarten and she was in third grade. And there was some boy picking on her on the playground or something. And I don't even remember what it was about. But she told me to go and kick him in the balls. So I did. So I guess that peacemaking and fighting at the same time.
Wait, was kicking him in the balls the peacekeeper?
Well, in my mind it was because I was defending my sister. And that kid was afraid of me until he got out of school.
I am learning so much about my family.
Yeah.
For the listeners at home, the last three stories were all the same cousins.
Yep. Definitely a cry for Dr. Phil. Someone's got to get in there.
They are all dead now. They were found dead together. Big tragedy.
I was never a peacekeeper.
I have a peacekeeping story, except for when kids would say racial slurs at me on the playground. I was a bit of a peacemaker, and people below a certain age won't be able to relate to this, but imagine, if you will, an ancient time on this planet where children played outside with their neighbor kids. I know it sounds strange, it sounds unbelievable, but this was a thing that happened once upon a time. On Saturday, your parents would just let you go outside and run around some random part of the neighborhood completely unsupervised with other children. And generally, children did not die when this happened. So this group of neighborhood kids that would play, at some point or another, some parent had the really foolish idea to get us these like plastic swords. And so we started playing make-believe out in the neighborhood, and we had magic powers and we had swords, obviously, and there were conflicts ginned up and there were imaginary monsters and that kind of thing. But occasionally, some kid or another would just be in a mood where they really wanted to whack the crap out of somebody else with a sword. These were like hard plastic, not like PVC hard, but like hard plastic swords. And they would leave marks. There would be questions. There would be nobody's playing outside for a certain number of weeks if things got a bit too heated. And so I started diplomatically preventing this from happening by catching wind of the moment. Somebody had a wild hair, as it were, and story making around how there was some greater threat that we had to fight other than Brian or Derek. Like, no, it's not Derek. Derek has been mind controlled by a demon or something. And so we would throw pine cones at a tree or something. It was creating imaginary violence to prevent actual violence.
Sounds like a young D&D master.
A little bit, but LARPing.
So I saw the camera go over to Nate for a second. Did he have a story?
I do, but that was just Alice moving it over.
Oh.
So this is a good one, because trying to do the right thing is social suicide. And in sixth grade, we all played football at recess. And there were like three main classes. And two of the kids from two different classes had like a real feud between the two of them. And they got into a fight. And like they were about to start swinging. And I thought, I've seen all these TV shows and things where good kid goes in. And I was like, okay, guys, let's just say, you know, like, chill out. Let's just stop fighting, everybody. And every single person started laughing at me. And it was, but it stopped the fight. And it was very hilarious. I found it funny too, because I was just like, this is exactly the worst case scenario for trying to stop a fight, you know, but it worked out.
comic relief, man. Yeah. I think that's a good thing though, man. Because like, I wonder if they could see how silly they were. You know, like,
yeah.
You have to be able to like laugh at yourself too. Like, it can't just be you.
Yeah.
Were there ever any moments when you were little that you felt like the glow was upon you?
Every day, I still do.
I mean, when I kicked that kid into the monkey bars, I felt incredibly powerful. I felt like my chi had truly concentrated around me, and that I was capable of godly things.
I mean, I imagine that the glow can come to you not just like when you are finding yourself like in a fight and your true power comes through your fighting. I think it can also just be like when you connect with something essential within yourself and you are fully expressed, I guess, in the moment.
I often feel singing.
With singing?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
If I could describe it as a glow, maybe competing in like a piano competition. I used to do those all the time when I was a kid. It was like one of like the first competitive events that I did, and I remember a lot as a kid. But finishing like a piece that you worked really, really hard on for a really long time and doing it in front of a group of people with no mistakes, big old glow. Big old glow.
Like, to continue the music, also dancing. I remember in my 20s going to a club and just like no one had to be dancing around me or with me, just fully expressing myself and feeling the music and the rhythm. I felt very powerful, and it was just for me.
You're saying you felt the beat of the rhythm of the night and danced until the morning light? Okay, cool.
I think being in the closet for me for so long, I felt like I played almost a character of what people would expect from me. And like there always being a fear of coming out, and then finally just being like, you know, like what the heck, like, and that's stupid. It was like, literally Lance Bass is one of the reasons that I came out. And I'm like, if Lance can do it, I can do it. And then I'm like, you know, before you know it, I'm on the phone with Bailey. She's the first person I told. And the first time that I like said it out loud, and then I like just started being me. I'm like, wow, like now I have a whole new ability. Now I have a whole new power that I can use to be my true self. And like that, breaking down that fear is what like helped me find my glow. So that was definitely a glowish moment for me.
Alice, you have something to say?
I've never felt the glow.
You have plenty of time.
I have also never really felt a glow, so it's okay if you don't. You can just go into the sciences. I like science.
Okay, with that, thank you so much for sharing this movie with us. Do you have any final thoughts before we sign off?
Just do me a favor and share it with us, with others, you know, if you liked it, because it's just a great film and so much fun to watch over and over and over again.
Thank you, everybody, for coming and participating and sharing your thoughts and your stories. Until next time, this has been Memory Static. Return your videos.
Return your videos here.
Return your videos here.
Return your videos here.
creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me. Every creature has a glow, and the glow is within me.
The Memory Static Podcast is hosted and edited by Bailey Moore, with original score and additional sound editing by Indigo Starbeam. The slow-moving time machine is voiced by... Original song is written by Bailey Moore and Indigo Starbeam. Find more music at IndigoStarbeam.com. To learn more about the film events, follow Memory Static Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. If you like the show, please consider donating to our Patreon. If you have stories to share about any movie we've covered, please write us at memorystatic@gmail.com. Special thanks to our guest, Nolan Roseman. And thank you to all of our party guests. And thank you for listening. Goodbye.